I'm grateful to be able to speak to you again about Jesus. We're going to get into Mark chapter 8 tonight, and there are videos available up to this point in Mark, and you can find them on my Facebook page, which is just Steve Kennard. You can find them on my Vimeo page, which is Dr. G. Steve Kennard. I also understand the Disciples Today has put them up. They wrote me and said, can we use these? And I said, fine. So I think you can find them on Disciples Today. And I don't know where else, but anywhere they are, I hope that you'll find them. And I hope that you will be able to be inspired from them. I mean, that's the point, really, of the Gospel of Mark, is to inspire us, to help us to see Jesus. And honestly, tonight, and what we're going to do in our next lesson, is my favorite part of the Gospel of Mark. We're going to go through Mark 8 through 10 in the next two lessons. So we're going through Mark 8 through chapter 9, verse 1, and tonight. And then the next time we pick it up will be in Mark 9 and 10. And I'm going to go ahead and teach on some other chapters. So you'll have to skip a section. And then you'll write some other chapters before, because the last session, I definitely want to spend that on the cross and the resurrection. So that's going to be a lesson on the crucifixion and the resurrection in part 4. But these two lessons are going to be about Jesus really talking to his disciples and teaching his disciples about discipleship, which I think is the core and the heart of Mark's gospel, is Mark teaching on discipleship. And teaching specifically on discipleship, it's followers of Jesus need to understand that being a part of the kingdom makes them a part of something that's countercultural. But they did not get that. The disciples did not get that. They were expecting Jesus just to follow in the type of Messiah that they were expecting as a culture, but he wasn't going to be like that. And so he really had to work with them in this part of the Gospels right here. And he changes his focus. If you remember last time, and if you've been following the videos, all the way up till about the middle of Mark, Mark has basically one idea in mind, and that is to show that Jesus is the Son of God. And he does that through his teachings. He does that through his miracles, especially through the miracle stories. And he was doing it to the crowds and to a lot of people. But now he's changing his focus, and you'll see this in Mark 8, the middle of Mark 8, he turns now to his disciples, and he spends more time with his disciples alone, and he's trying to get them to see not so much that Jesus, yes, he is the Son of God, but more than that. He's trying to get his disciples to see that Jesus is a type of Messiah that they haven't expected. And because he's that type of Messiah, he requires a type of discipleship that they haven't expected. And that's really a huge part of what the Gospel of Mark is all about. So we have a lot to cover. I'm going to jump in now and we'll get into the text. We'll read it and I will just give you some comments on it as we go. We're going to start in Mark 8, verse 22. And tonight we're going to finish Mark 8. And then I want to encourage you to go ahead and read Mark 9 and 10 to get ready for the next time that we're together. And I'll make some videos on some other things, 11 and 12, along with that. Okay. We're looking tonight at Jesus healing the blind man of Bethsaida. And in this section here, beginning in Mark 8, 22, down through Mark 10, you'll notice that Mark 8 begins, or this section in Mark 8, 22 begins with Jesus healing a blind man. And then in chapter 10, it's going to end with Jesus healing a blind man. And what they call that structurally is it's a sandwich, okay? This is theologically or structurally in the narrative, it's a sandwich. Jesus begins with a story and matches a story, and all in between, Jesus is trying to show his disciples who are blind to who he is to have sight. He's trying to help them to have sight about who he really is. So he begins with the story of a blind man, ends with the story of a blind man. And three times between Mark 8 and a half, let me just put it that way, and Mark 10, he's going to predict his crucifixion and his resurrection. Three different times. Each time he's going to get more specific about the details of his crucifixion and his resurrection. And every time he makes that prediction, the disciples don't understand it. and they don't understand it in really bad ways, like Peter rebuking Jesus, like James and John asking who's going to be first, and can we sit on the right and your left in the kingdom, that kind of thing. But also every time Jesus spends more time teaching them about what it means to be a disciple of his. He doesn't give up on them. And that's a huge part of Mark 8, 9, and 10. Jesus working with his disciples until they get who he really is. So we'll jump in here at Mark chapter 22. And this is the first story of the healing of a blind man. It says they arrived in Bethsaida. And like I said, I'll make some comments. And I want you to know this is going to be different than whatever Bible you're reading, because it's my own translation. I call it the King Jesus translation. And hopefully it'll be out maybe next year. We'll see. But anyway, it's going to read differently. They arrived in Bethsaida. Now, Bethsaida is one of the cities on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. It is one of the three cities that Jesus ministered to the most. And it's known by scholars as the Evangelical Triangle. So Capernaum, Bethsaida, and Chorazin are the Evangelical Triangle. It literally means house of fish. And so it was a city on the Sea of Galilee, a town, and mostly the people that lived there, the industry was fishing, the fishing industry. And Jesus spent quite a bit of time there. You can visit there even today. You can go and you can see the archaeological ruins of all three of those cities, Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. Okay, Jesus arrived in Bethsaida, and so he's in the Jewish territory. They brought to him a blind man and urged him to touch the man. Now notice, it's the people that bring the blind man to Jesus. Sometimes when we hear about miracle stories, we hear, the person has to have faith, and especially true today in miracle healings and that sort of thing, in some churches and that sort of thing. But in the New Testament, Jesus healed people because there was a need. And in this case, the person, he's just brought to Jesus. And it's his friends that say, hey, can you help him? The same thing with true with the paralytic, where the friends dug through the rooftop. Doesn't mention the paralytic's faith. It mentions the friends had faith. And they got him to Jesus. And I think an important subpoint in that is, it's important just to bring people to Jesus. Bring people to Jesus and let him work and see what he will do. They brought to Jesus a blind man and urged him to touch the man. Now, I want you to notice this, because this is just something that you'll find throughout the Gospel of Mark in these miracle stories. It says, taking the hand of the blind man. Jesus was constantly reaching out and touching people. He knew the power of touch. He knew the power of being close to people. And I mentioned this in the video lessons. Jesus he didn't want to just heal the person and that's it and over with. He wanted to touch the person. He wanted to heal the inside of the person. He wanted to make the person whole from the inside out. And that's what he does here. He takes the blind man by the hand. Notice that he leads him outside the village. And so there's no one there, it appears, no one there now but Jesus and the blind man. And that idea of outside the village is very important in Mark, because there's constantly language of outsider and insider. And it's the insiders that Jesus is going to be working with the most in this section, the disciples, but they often appear as outsiders, where it's those who aren't insiders, they're on the outside coming in, that appear to get Jesus better, like this blind man here, okay? So Jesus led him outside the village. He spit on the man's eyes and placed his hands on him. And it seems like that since he was blind, that touch again with the saliva on the eye and placing his hands on him, he's letting him know, I'm about to do something here. I have to do something special for you here. He asked, do you see anything? And looking up, the man said, I see people that look like trees walking around. And so he begins by having sight, but not complete sight. He sees a little bit, but he doesn't see clearly. And notice, Jesus is not going to leave him in that state. He's not going to leave him in the state where he sees people, but they look like trees. Instead, it says, once again, he placed his hands on the man's eyes. The man opened his eyes wide and his sight was restored. He began to stare with eyes wide open and to see clearly. And I like the way that the Greek states that. He began to stare with eyes wide open and to see clearly. Jesus sent him home saying, do not go into the village. Now, Jesus, this is often what is called by scholars as the second touch of grace. Because Jesus touches him once, he heals him, but it's not a complete healing. And so he reaches out and he touches him again. And that time he gets the whole healing. He sees clearly now. And that's really what Jesus is going to be doing in this whole next section in chapters 8, 9, and 10 with the disciples. Because they see him, but they don't see him clearly. And he's not just going to lead them there. And I think that as we're reading the gospel and as the original audience was reading the gospel, it's an opportunity for us to reflect on, okay, how do we see Jesus? And do we see him clearly? And if we don't see him clearly, can we ask him for a second touch of grace? I know personally in my own life, I've needed this second touch of grace time and time again. There are times where I didn't understand discipleship, or there are times where I let things take the place of my following Jesus as a disciple. And the thing is, Jesus will not give up on us. He'll keep working with us. And he will give us that second, sometimes third, fourth, fifth touch of grace. So one of the things I want to ask you to do over the weekend is just to sit and contemplate, meditate a little bit and ask yourself, okay, how am I doing personally understanding Jesus and being his disciple right now? And is there any area of my life where I need a second touch of grace, where I know that I see, but I don't see clearly? And I want to stare at Jesus with eyes wide open. So I encourage you to take a look at that and to think about that. And that's what we see happening in this story right here. Now, understand, and I think, I just want to see, as Jesus works with this person, there are times in all of our lives where we're going to need that second touch of grace. And it's going to come at different times in our lives. And but I hope it doesn't happen over and over and over again. I hope that our relationship with God is more like an elevator ride with Jesus or an escalator ride with Jesus instead of a constant roller coaster. But what you're going to see, if it is a roller coaster, don't get too discouraged. Okay, that's a huge point I want to make. If you have ups and downs with Jesus and ups and downs as a disciple, don't get too discouraged, because the original 12 did too. I mean, you look in chapters 8, 9, and 10 at some of the ways they're going to respond to Jesus predicting his death and resurrection, and it's off-putting, honestly. It's like, disciples, where are you? Where is your head right now? What are you thinking? Because they were on this roller coaster ride with Jesus. Now, don't get me wrong. I love roller coasters. I don't know about you, but I'm a big fan of roller coasters. And, you know, the scarier, the faster, the better. I even like the old wooden ones, you know, where you just get bumped all over the place. They have one of those at Great Adventure that I don't know how, it's so old. But you walk out and you just need to go straight to a chiropractor, you know. It is so bumpy. But I just love roller coasters, but I don't want my spiritual life to look like that, okay? I don't want my spiritual life to look like, oh, Steve just got off a roller coaster. I want it to be more of a nice upward climb with Jesus, just maturing all the time. But having said that, there are roller coaster moments in all of our lives. And if you find yourself right now in that roller coaster moment, do not get too discouraged. Don't get too down. Because you'll look in chapters 8, 9, and 10, and that's exactly where the disciples are. But Jesus doesn't give up on them. He gets them to where they need to be. And that's the great thing about Jesus. So let's look at the next section here, verses 27 through 30, Peter's declaration, and just continuing this thought. Okay, 27. Jesus and his apprentices went to the village of Caesarea Philippi. Now, Caesarea Philippi is in the north of Galilee. In fact, it's about as far north as you can go in Galilee without hitting the border of Syria and going into Syria, Lebanon, or Syria. And so it's quite a journey from Bethsaida. Jesus takes them up to this town, which is in the foothills of the of Mount Hermon, and there he's going to teach them a little bit more. So he takes them away. They go to this village, and notice it says they went to the village of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way, this concept of on the way is huge in the Gospel of Mark, especially in this section right here. And on the way sometimes means just the literal road, and they're walking together, but it often means there's a double entendre going on, that has a double meaning. And they're on the way to Caesarea Philippi, but they're also on the way to learning more about Jesus. And Jesus is going to teach them while they're on the way. And they're actually going to a village that was built in honor of Caesar. And it was built by one of the Herods, Herod Philip. And so it has this double stamp of being Roman and Roman hierarchy and Roman rule. And sort of thinking of leading like the Romans, or lording it over people like the Romans. And that's what Caesarea Philippi was all about. It was also a city filled with temples, pagan temples. The main temple, well, it was actually, the city was dedicated to the god Pan. And so its name in the first century also was Panius. Today it's called Banius, same name, but it's Banius is Arab, and there's no P sound in Arabic, and so there's a B sound instead, Banius, but that's to the god Pan. There was a temple built to Caesar Augustus, which backed up to a mountain, and there was a cave in the back of that mountain, and the cave was said to be the gates of Hades. And so when Jesus is talking about the gates of Hades, there was literally a place where they were walking to that had the gates of Hades. And the gates of Hades and all these Roman temples and all this Roman religion, according to Matthew's account, wasn't going to be able to conquer Jesus' kingdom. But on the way to that, that's what I'm trying to get you to see. On the way to thinking about Rome, to thinking about Roman rulers, to thinking about Roman religion, Jesus is going to have a talk with them. And he questions them and he says, "Who do people say I am?" They answered him, "Some say John the Immerser, others Elijah, and others that you are one of the prophets." And so basically prophetic figures, you're one of the prophets. And he asked them, "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, you're Christos," which means the Messianic King. You are the Christ, the Messianic King. And Jesus warned them not to speak to anyone about this, continues the Messianic secret. But what I want you to see here is after the story of the blind man of Bethsaida, Jesus now asks them, okay, what do you understand about me? First, what are people saying about me? But what is your understanding? Who do you think I am? And Peter seems to get it right because he says, you're Christ, you're Messiah. But you also have to define Messiah. What does Messiah really mean? And Jesus is going to do that for them, and they're going to misunderstand it. And that's what we get in the next section here. So we'll just go on down to verse 31. And I want you to see verse 31 begins the first of three prediction cycles, three predictions of his death and resurrection in chapters 8, 9, and 10. And this is the first one. And here's how the cycle goes. The cycle begins with Jesus very clearly stating that he's going to die and be raised, give other details about it as well. Then number two, the disciples are going to misunderstand, and usually misunderstand royally, okay? And then number three, he's going to not give up on them, but teach them. He's going to teach them a little more. So he's going to explain who he is as a Messiah. They're going to miss it altogether. And he's going to explain a little bit more so that they finally will ultimately get it. So this is another important, I love the way that Mark just puts all of these sections together right here. because it's a story within a story that's being told in this part of Mark. So we'll look in verse 31, the first of the prediction cycles. Now, remember what Peter has just said. You are the Christ. And now Jesus is going to explain what that means. He is the Messianic King. Because in that day and time, there were all kinds of teachings about the Messiah. And it's important to, well, if you know some history, early history, first century history, it's helpful. Also, if you can ever go to the Holy Land, it's helpful because these places that I'm talking about, like Bethsaida and Caesarea Philippi, you can actually walk in those villages, the archaeological digs of those villages, and you can picture these things now. But most in the first century, what people were mostly looking for as Messiah was a physical king over a physical kingdom that was going to kick the Romans out of the land. And that's true of many of the Jewish leaders. It's also true of different small groups like the Sicarii and the Essenes, if you've heard of them. I'm reading this book right now, and I'm only about a fourth of the way through it with it. So I hate to recommend books that I haven't read all the way. So I'm not going to say I recommend this book, but I'm enjoying it so far. And it's called The Shadow of the Galilean. And what this German scholar has done, Gerd Thiessen, what he has done is he's taken a narrative story that he's created, but he's basically telling the historical story about Jesus and John the Baptist also. And so he talks a lot about the Romans. He talks a lot about the Essenes. He talks a lot about what's going on in the first century. He talks about different messianic leaders that came that caused Peter and others to think, oh, this is the type of leader Jesus is going to be, like Judas Maccabeus and others that wanted to basically kick the Romans out of the land. And so that's what Peter has in mind, but Jesus is going to try to show him that's not the Messiah I'm going to be. So in verse 31, Jesus begins to teach them that it was necessary. And there's a small little Greek word there called dei. And dei, just, it means literally that. It is necessary. It's just three little letters, but it's a very important word because it's saying this is what needs to happen here. Jesus begins to teach them that it was necessary for the Son of Man to, and look at this, to suffer many things, to be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the experts of the religious law, and to be killed, and after 3 days rise. Jesus spoke plainly about this matter. So Jesus is talking to his disciples and he's trying to help them to see this idea of Jesus being the Christ, the Messianic King. It's true, but I'm going to be a Messianic King in this way. I'm going to suffer. I'm going to be mistreated. I'm going to die, and I'm going to rise again. And it's necessary for the Son of Man, which is a messianic title from the book of Daniel, it's necessary for him to do it that way. And so that's the kind of Messiah I'm going to be, which means that if you're my disciples, you're going to follow that Messiah, and it has an impact on the way that you live your life. Now notice what Peter does. Peter, who just made this statement that you are the Christ, now it says, Peter took him aside and he began to rebuke him. So Peter doesn't get it. This is the first of the cycle. Jesus is very clear about what must happen to him. And Peter rebukes him. No, it's not going to be that way. No, that's not necessary. No, it is not going to happen that way. We signed up for a different reason and it's not going to happen that way. And so what happens next is Jesus turned and saw his apprentices. He looks and he sees all the disciples seeing Peter and hearing Peter's statement. And so he rebukes Peter. Now, this word rebuke has been used in Mark before. And it was used by Jesus when he was rebuking an evil spirit. So basically, Peter takes Jesus out and rebukes him like this, that's an evil spirit talking. But Jesus turns it around because he really is now rebuking the evil spirit in the heart of Peter, because Satan is there. And this is an important point, a really important point. Rebuking Peter, he said, "Get behind me, Satan. Your mind is not set on the interest of God, but on human matters." Now, I want you to think about that statement right there. Your mind is not set on the interest of God, but on human matters. Because anytime human matters take over thoughts about God and spirituality and being like Jesus, that's satanic. And that's what we need to keep out of our lives. We got to make sure we don't replace God for human matters. We have to keep human matters in their place and make sure God is God and Jesus is Lord and the Spirit is leading us, but we can't substitute one for the other, because that's satanic. And that's what Peter does here. He takes over these human matters about his thoughts about the kingdom, his thoughts about a physical kingdom, his thoughts about a military ruler, his thoughts about power, his thoughts about control, and he rebukes Jesus. And Jesus says, "You've got things misplaced, and you need to realize I am going to be the suffering servant." And then it says in verse 34, he begins to teach them more about discipleship. That's the third part of the cycle that I talked about. Jesus will predict his death and resurrection. They'll misunderstand it, usually royally. Peter makes a royal blunder here, rebuking Jesus. But Jesus doesn't give up on them, just like he will not give up on any of us. And he's going to teach them more thoroughly. So he summons the crowd and his apprentices and says to them, and this is a great teaching on discipleship, and you're going to receive three great teachings on discipleship in 8, 9, and 10. This is the first one. "If anyone wishes to follow me," notice he's talking to the crowd and to the disciples. And he doesn't just look at the disciples and say, "Hey, if you want to follow me, this is what you need to do." He looks at all of them and uses the word anyone. The standard of discipleship is the same for everybody, all right? "If anyone wishes to follow me, then you must." And if you're going to follow a suffering Messiah, then there's going to be some suffering in your own life. So he says, you must deny self, take up the cross, and follow me. He's just talked about his own death. And that death, ultimately, we know, and the readers know also, was on a cross. And he says, you're also going to have a cross. So deny self, take up your cross, and follow me. And really, it needs to be in that order, that we have to have self-denial and not be selfish, but be selfless. Then we have to take up a cross and we follow. And then in verse 35, "For whoever wishes to save your life will lose it, and whoever loses your life for my sake or the gospel will save it. What good is it if you gain the whole world and forfeit your eternal life? What would you give in exchange for your life?" This is very countercultural, but that's the type of Messiah that Jesus is. And it's upside down, because Jesus has an upside down way of thinking about the world and teaching about what it means to be spiritual. And it's countercultural because in our culture, especially our Western culture, we act like the most successful people, or to be a successful person, it's about gaining the world. It's about getting rich. It's about making money. It's about buying things. It's about possessions. That's what's going to make you successful, to make you happy. And that's what people chase after in life. And Jesus says in his kingdom, it's going to be different than that. It's not about chasing after things. It's actually about giving up things. And it's not about trying to put yourself first. It's about putting yourself last. It's about being a servant. And it's about servant leadership, because that's who Jesus was. So if you wish to save your life, you got to give it away. You got to lose it. You got to invest in people and give to people instead of just selfishly following what you desire in life. That's part of self-denial. That's part of taking up your cross. You've got to lose your life for the gospel, then you'll save it. And then what good is it, he says, if you get all these things and end up with, you know, just a boatload of possessions, but then you've lost your soul after that. You forfeit eternal life. He says, you don't profit a thing. So what would you give in exchange for your life? Understand this upside down concept of the kingdom, which is not about power, shouldn't be about power, shouldn't be about control. It also shouldn't be about riches and things and possessions. It should be about serving people, helping people, honoring others. It should be about seeking after justice, taking care of those who can't take care of themselves, being concerned with people, showing empathy for people, hurting when people hurt. It should be about those who are dispossessed and disinherited and don't have rights, that we take a stand with them and we try to help them to better themselves in their lives. That's what Jesus did. You look at the ministry of Jesus up to this point, and that's what he's been doing, pouring out his life for other people. And ultimately, he's going to pour out his life to the point of actually dying on the cross for everyone. And he says, if you're going to be his disciple, you've got to embrace that lifestyle. That's the lifestyle of following Jesus. So it's a countercultural way of looking at things. Verse 38, whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of that person when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. And so he says, you know, basically you can't be ashamed of me. And then in verse 9, verse 1, and we'll close with this verse, but I think this verse goes with everything that he's just said. So I include it here. And you got to remember that in the original manuscripts, there are no chapter divisions and no verse divisions. They came much, much later. Jesus said to them, I tell you the truth. And this I tell you the truth is usually a rabbinic formula that finishes a statement. So the rabbis would quote a lot of different rabbis, and then they would say, and I say to you, or I tell you the truth, or amen, I say to you. And that's what Jesus is doing here. He's saying there are some who are standing here who will not die before they see the kingdom of God come in power. So the kingdom of God is coming, and it's coming in power, but it's a different power than what Peter is expecting. And some of them are going to be alive to see it. And when they see it, he's trying to get them to see, understand, it's not going to be about military might. It's not going to be about soldiers. It's not going to be about building a government. It's not going to be about taxation. It's not going to be about building a capital city or anything like that. It's going to be about serving other people. It's going to be about helping people. It's going to be about pouring out your life for other people. That's the type of Messiah I am, and those are the type of followers that I expect to follow me. Now, it's one more point that I think is very interesting. What follows right after this story? And you can just look at the next section. And we won't do it tonight. Well, I'm gonna save it actually for one of the videos. But if you look in verses 2 and following, it's the transfiguration, where Jesus is transfigured before Peter, James, and John, and the voice of God speaks. And basically says, this is my son, listen to him. And before he says that, Moses appears and Elijah appears, the great lawgiver Moses and the great prophet Elijah. And what does Peter say at that point? Peter, he says, let's build three booths or three tabernacles. And that was to honor Jesus, Moses, and Elijah. But before he can carry that out, God speaks. God speaks and says, you don't need three. You only need one. This is my beloved son. Listen to him. Just follow him. Follow him. That's what you need to do. But the point, here's another point I want to make, and I hope you get this. Okay, just follow me here. When we talk about chapter 9, verse 1, most of the time I hear it talked about, I hear it saying, there are some who are standing here who will not die before they see the kingdom of God come in power. Have any of you heard that in the kingdom study that we've done before? Some of you have been around long enough to have known the old kingdom study. And in the old kingdom study, this is one of the points that we made here, saying that, you know, some of them were standing there, they would see the kingdom come with power, which means that they would be alive to see the kingdom come with power. However, it infers that somebody would be dead, and Judas died, but the rest of them were alive. So Judas died, the rest were alive, and they saw the kingdom come in Acts chapter 2 with the coming of the church. And so this is a prediction of the church, and the church is coming, and that sort of thing. And not to, that's a possible way of looking at it, okay? It is possible. But I don't think that fits contextually. Contextually, I don't think that's what this verse is about. I think what this verse is about, he's saying some of you are going to be around to see the kingdom come with power. And then guess what? Boom. Verse 2, that happens with the transfiguration, with Jesus being metamorphed, changed, transfigured, and the Greek word is metamorph, that's why I said that, changed right in front of them, and God saying, this is my son, listen to him. That's the kingdom coming with power, because the kingdom is manifested in many different ways in the Bible, and not just in the church, but in the life and the ministry of Jesus. The kingdom was there in his life. So what is the point of all of this? Why spend this time talking about this? Because I think, honestly, I do really believe this is the central core part of Mark's gospel. I think this is the big reason why he was writing the gospel, is to help people see who Jesus was. He asked the question Jesus does, who do people say I am? Well, who do you say I am? And they say the Christ. Okay, but what does that really mean? Jesus is explaining that he is the suffering Messiah, and he came into the world to bring a kingdom into the world that is countercultural, that is upside down to the way the world thinks. And as disciples of Jesus, that's the type of follower that Jesus wants. He wants people that are going to be countercultural. He wants a kingdom that's countercultural. He wants some disciples who are going to be servant leaders and just servants and serve each other. And the disciples don't get that. The disciples misunderstand that. They misunderstand it not just this one time, but two more times coming up. They're going to misunderstand it. Ultimately, they'll get it after Jesus dies and is risen from the dead, and they can reflect back on that and see, wow, he really did rise. He really did die the way he said he was going to, and he really did rise. Therefore, the life that he lived is the life that we ought to live also. And Jesus lived a life serving other people. So my encouragement to all of us tonight is to reflect on our own lives and see if we are demonstrating a countercultural way of living in the world around us, so that we are a light to the world, drawing people by our life and by what we say. I think it was Augustine that said, or maybe it was St. Francis, one of the two. I think it was Augustine, actually, who said, the only Bible that most people will ever read is the one they see lived out in your life. And so you have to be a light to the world. And if you act like the world around you, nobody's going to notice that. They're just going to, oh, there's just another selfish person living life like everybody else is living it. But if we live differently from the world, that is a bright light. And it causes people to think, to wonder. And there's a possibility for them then to be drawn in. It was St. Francis who said, he said, preach and use words seldom. And what he meant by that was your life should be your best sermon. So preach, but you don't need many words to preach, because you ought to be preaching with your life. And Francis was known for, and his followers known for, serving people. And that's how they got the message out, was they just served and served and served. And so I want to encourage all of us that in order to embrace Jesus as the Messiah the way he wants us to, we have to be servants. And we'll see this even more specifically stated and clearly stated in another section in Mark. But for now, he's introducing it really for the first time. I would say that Jesus now is, he's given them that first touch, like he gave the blind man of Bethsaida, but he's going to give them a second touch, and he's going to give them a third touch, because they won't see it right now, but eventually they will. And the good thing is for all of us, wherever we are in our spiritual walk, wherever we are trying to follow Jesus, he'll keep reaching out and touching us. He'll keep working with us. He's not going to give up on us. Let's not give up on him, because he wants us to understand who he is, so that together as a community, we can be a bright light to people around us. Thank you.